Hello, and welcome to Revolutionize Your Love Life. Do you want to know more about love relationships, what makes them work, how to create the one of your best dreams? Do you want to be in a really healthy, juicy love relationship? In these podcasts, we will give ideas and practical advice to light your way. Whether you're looking for a love partner, already in a relationship you wish could be better, or leaving one that has run its course, there will be something to inspire, empower, and support you. Revolutionize Your Love Life is a fortnightly podcast where you will access the knowledge and wisdom of love experts and relationship coaches from across the world to help you find true fulfillment in love. I am your host, Heather Garbutt. Welcome. There are many types of toxic relationships that can deeply affect our sense of self. A relationship underpinned by power and control is one type of these toxic relationships. Today, we'll be looking at power and control relationships as part of a four-part series, and Helen Eisenhower is here with me today to help us untangle these extremely toxic power and control relationships. And she'll assist us to understand the dynamics and what we can find to do for ourselves if we are in one of these relationships. Now, Helen, it's lovely Helen Eisenhower, hails from Australia and has worked with vulnerable young people, families and communities for over 27 years. She's a qualified social worker, counsellor, trained mediator, and has worked with many groups of people, including adults with disabilities, children and young people in and out of the home care system, women and children experiencing domestic violence, perpetrators of violence, and families experiencing separation. She currently works in the area of mental health and has a passion for empowering people in their lives and relationships. Now, I have met lovely Helen with Catherine Woodward Thomas, and we are both conscious uncoupling coaches trained by Catherine. That's our connection. Welcome, Helen. It's Hi, lovely Heather. Of you to do this for us. Thank you.
No problem.
So let's just look at, what does a power and control relationship look like? Can you define it for us a little bit?
Absolutely, Heather. A power and control relationship is one in which one person uses a series of behaviours and tactics over another person with the aim to dominate and control that person, and also with the aim for that person to be fearful of them and submit to them and effectively be controlled by them. They're often referred to as, you might hear power and control relationships referred to as domestic violence relationships or domestic and family violence, also abusive relationships or coercive controlling violence. But at the end of the day, it is where one person uses a series and a pattern of behaviours and tactics to actually gain dominance and control over another person.
Right, that's really helpful. And I wonder if you can really define for us how this is different from the, you know, old-fashioned man-in-charge relationship when women were generally in the home and men were the breadwinners, the power imbalance that was implicit in that. So what's different from that in these relationships you're talking about?
Absolutely, yes. My parents grew up in that era, and a lot of women still live in those types of relationships today where the man has, I guess, implicitly a bit more power. He might be the worker, he might go out and be the breadwinner. The woman might have traditionally stayed at home. In those relationships, while women were often, you know, kind of taught in a way or encouraged to submit to their partners, men held decision-making power a lot of those times, those relationships are quite traditional in their power. The man does hold more power, but there's two key differences in those relationships compared to a coercive or controlling relationship. The first one is that the woman, if you like, doesn't live in fear. So in a traditional relationship, the female partner, for example, even though the male might have a bit more power, she can still speak her mind, they can still have conflict, and they can still, you know, do the ins and outs of a relationship without her feeling fearful and controlled. And the second key point of why it's different is because the male doesn't use coercive and abusive and domineering tactics to actually gain control over the other person. So while domestic violence, one of the key theories is that it's gendered, meaning that men have a lot of power in our society and therefore that can be taken to the extreme where men can dominate women, they're two entirely different types of relationships.
Yeah, I get it. It's somehow there's a mutual agreement in traditional relationships that one person takes one role and one person takes another, whereas there's no agreement at all, really.
You're exactly right. In a traditional relationship, both partners have rights and they respect the rights of each other, and it is by mutual agreement that maybe one person has more rights. Hmm. In a domestic violence relationship, one person has all the rights and all the power, and the other person has no power but all the responsibility. So they're very different dynamics that underpin both of those relationships.
That's really lovely that you've clarified that so clearly. Mm-hmm. So with the power and control relationships, you know, how prevalent are these?
Look, sadly, they're quite prevalent, and they're not even sure how prevalent they are because there is a lot of underreporting of domestic violence, and in our later podcast we'll explain why that is. But you're looking at between 20 and 25% of women, at least in Australia, report having been either emotionally or sexually abused. You're also looking at the fact that women generally are much more at risk of violence from an intimate partner or an ex-partner than they are from a stranger. And I know in Australia we've got a terrible, tragic situation where at least one woman per week is killed by her intimate partner or her ex-partner. Around the world, the general consensus is that around about 94 to 95% of the victims of domestic violence are women. However, in saying that, we need to realise that men can also be victims of domestic violence, and often that abuse can be physical, but it also is usually much more emotional. However, for our purposes today, we'll be talking mainly about intimate partner violence, and we'll be talking mainly about the female as the victim. However, it works, you know, it does happen both ways.
Okay. And I'm assuming in that context that it doesn't only apply to heterosexual relationships.
Absolutely, Heather. Some studies show that intimate partner abuse is just as prevalent in lesbian and gay relationships as it is in heterosexual relationships. I know there's more research being done in that area. However, I guess if you're looking at the fact that this is intimate partner violence, at this point it doesn't really matter whether the intimate partners are gay, heterosexual, or what type of exact relationship that is. This is about one partner controlling and coercing another.
That's excellent. Very well, very clearly and well put. So if after today people realise they're in one of these relationships, what can they do?
That's actually a complex question, because one of the thoughts is that if you're a woman, for example, listening today, and we'll explore a lot more about the types of abuse here, but if you're listening today thinking, oh, this might be me, standing up to the person that's kind of the controlling person or the perpetrator, if you like, that's not actually safe. So the most important thing is, once you realise that this might be you, the most important thing is to stay safe in the first instance, and then in a much safer space to then think about how you might leave this relationship or what else you might do. I always encourage victims of domestic violence to actually connect with a specialised domestic violence service in their area. Google's great. You know, you can go on and actually find those services and actually connect with a service, because they will help you do the safety planning. They will help you, I guess, identify how bad this situation or how dangerous it might be for you, And then help you take the steps to do some safety planning and maybe then talk to you about or supporting you to make plans to leave. I guess a decision that I might be, this might be me, to then a decision to leave and then actually leaving are three very different things, and they're a phased approach, and that's what we encourage women to do to keep themselves and their children, if they have children, safe.
I love that, that there's a step-by-step plan that you can create. Yeah. It's a real pathway out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also, while we're talking about this, Heather, standing up, you know, some women hear some of this information and they get very angry and indignant, and they want to stand up to the abuser. And I encourage women not to do that. That's actually not safe. So once again, this is about a staged approach that is really about keeping the woman and children safe while they then do some planning or learn some other skills in how to manage this.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. That's lovely. So can you tell me, Helen, what are the varying ways that power and control dynamics show up in a relationship?
Absolutely, Heather. I think one of the first things I'll say is that there are around 11 different kind of categories of abuse in an intimate partner relationship. One of the main things that people see and hear about in the media is physical abuse. So physical abuse is one way that a relationship can become coercive and controlling, where one person threatens, intimidates, hits or punches, you know, pushes or shoves the other person. Mm. That is, it's important to know that physical abuse does not occur in every violent relationship. However, that doesn't mean the relationship is not violent. So there are many other ways of controlling another person and being violent towards them that does not include being physical.
Okay.
In saying that, physical abuse, it can be extremely dangerous, and it is very damaging to a woman and her children, and many women end up with severe injuries from physical abuse. Other forms of abuse, Heather, that are, you know, all of them are just as important as each other. For example, there's verbal abuse. Now, verbal abuse can be yelling at someone, swearing at someone, name-calling, you know, teasing. It can even be as subtle as teasing and slight put-downs.
Yes, it's that unkind edge, I guess. It's the unkind.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And they also, in some research, they talk about contempt, you know, as being, you know, as that edge being, you know, contempt. Being on the other end of that over time is extremely affects the victim. It decreases their self-esteem. It makes them start to believe that those things are true, and it's very frightening. Mm. There's also things like that might seem more kind of oblique, things like financial abuse. And that might be, you know, that can be very complex too, because some financial abuse can be where, you know, the perpetrator takes all the money and leaves no money for the other person. It can also be where the person, you know, the perpetrator gives money to the other person for small things like groceries, but no other money to spend. The perpetrator might control where all the money goes. They might go through the credit card statements. They might actually give the victim loads and loads of money. And then 3 months later, I've seen this in a situation where this woman had so much money, and then 3 months later her partner came back to her and said, I need to see all the receipts of what you've spent. And then the fear and intimidation of not being able to do that. So financial abuse can actually keep a woman totally isolated, or it can be very clever and subtle. It might also look like putting all the debts in the woman's name and putting all the assets in the other person's name.
Yes, so I've seen a lot of this.
Subtle.
Mm, I've seen a lot of this. Keeping the partner short, you know, they're trying to furnish the house and look after the children and not being given money, where the partner is going off and living the high life. You know, I've seen that so many times. Yeah.
Absolutely, Heather. And I've also seen the situation where, you know, women, when they go to leave a violent relationship, they actually realise that all the debts are in their name.
Yeah.
And they, so, you know, how difficult that becomes. All of that, that's on a continuum. All of that is financial abuse.
Yeah, yeah. And it really undermines confidence massively.
Absolutely. And it can be the one thing that stops women from leaving.
Mm. Yeah.
So they have no money, have no resources, and have a lot of debt. Mm. And some women choose to stay because it seems too hard.
Yeah. And all of these are about a sort of subtle or not so subtle cornering and disempowering.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And some of it can happen over time. So some women don't even realize that this slow disempowering is happening until they all of a sudden feel like they've lost themselves. Like they're just so small in the relationship, and they just, and that is then very, very hard to grab, find yourself and actually connect to leave.
Yeah.
And that is the purpose of the relationship. Mm. The purpose of the coercion is to make sure that that person doesn't leave.
Yes, absolutely. And I hear so many times, you know, the partner, the abusive partner saying, who's going to want you? Look at you. By the time they've actually diminished that person so much, that they will feel, oh, nobody else will want me. And they give over a sense of authority to the abuser, you know, that they must know. And me as the abused person doesn't really know. They believe them. And I think that's so dangerous.
I totally agree. And that's the real component of this that I can just name as brainwashing. So there's an emotionally abusive component to this where the perpetrator just keeps on telling the victim exactly what you've said. You're no good. No one will want you. And they also do things like deny that the abuse is happening. And they also minimize their behavior and they blame the other person. And over time, you know, the woman internalizes that voice and she starts to abuse herself with that voice. She starts to go, this is my fault. It isn't really happening. It's all in my head. And a lot of women start to feel quite, you know, coining the term, they tell me they feel crazy.
Mm.
They no longer know what is the reality, and therefore the perpetrator sets the reality.
Yep, yep.
And that is a very dangerous place to be in, and no wonder it is so hard for the female to leave.
Yeah, so the perpetrator actually wants the abused person to feel in a fog and completely disempowered, and that their reality is not the truth.
Absolutely, absolutely, Heather. And I've worked with so many, you know, women, and there's also men, and I don't want to say, you know, deny the fact that there are many men out there who are in the same situation at all. But many of the women that I've worked with on their first appointment, they come and see me and they say, I can't even tell you what's going on. I'm so foggy. I just don't know. I don't have words anymore. My head's all mush. And straight away I know, this is what emotional abuse feels like.
Right. So I've taken you off into a bit more detail there. I'm just wondering if you want to tell us what the other of the 11 possible ways of being emotionally abused and disempowered are.
Sure, absolutely. There's spiritual abuse, and that can be a denial of the person's right to their religious freedom and their right to worship or have their own beliefs. It can also be used as a way of, you know, re-abusing that person. So not only using the power of the perpetrator, but using the power of a deity, like God told me you're no good, or God told me, you know, using religious power to come over the top and actually dominate even further that victim. There's also...
That's hugely powerful. God's on my side.
Hugely powerful. Mm. Hugely, especially in religious families, you know, and I've worked with women whose husbands and partners have been, you know, really big in the church, even pastors, and this abuse is not, it doesn't only exist in one corner of society.
Mm.
It exists across all spectrums and all socioeconomic groups in society. And what we do find is that people that are in lower socioeconomic groups, the abuse is kind of more visible. So they kind of come to the attention of authorities often. However, this can happen in families that are rich, that are well off, that are well respected in the community, that, you know, the partner might be have very highly influential and very well recognized job. Sometimes the abuse can be so sophisticated and so hidden that no one would even guess. And those women are often the women that feel so trapped.
Mm. So that's the other piece is the isolation. I think maybe we're coming into that sort of angle.
Absolutely. Isolation is often can often be one of the first tactics that's used. However, it can be used at any time. Isolation is a very important tactic because what it does is it isolates the victim so that they have no other reality and it takes them away from their support networks. So how that might look is it might actually look like the perpetrator saying to the victim, you're not allowed to see your family, or it's them or me. You can't have us both. Or it might be more subtle where the perpetrator actually starts to criticise that person's friends or family over time, and that then the victim starts to believe that and thinks, well, actually, my family isn't all there for me, and they do, oh, okay, and they start to then isolate themselves. Mm. Or it could take the form of preventing people from going out or moving out into the woods. A lot of women that I've worked with have lived in quite isolated places without transport and things like that. So it can be a social isolation as well as a physical isolation.
Mm. It's that sort of old cliche, barefoot and pregnant.
Yes, yes. Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And moving interstate or moving away from the victim support networks or their job and, you know, taking them kind of away in this can feel very romantic on the one level. But the reality of it is that the person's, you know, purposely getting that person away from what they know so that they can have more control.
I want to touch on that with you because I'm thinking about love bombing. In the early stages of a relationship that can feel really romantic, it can be that the perpetrator is promising all of the things that every woman would want, or they particularly work out what that woman wants and promises all of those things. Through that, sort of gains a real deep trust and a feeling of promise, you know, and then it turns around and that's when the abuse begins. When the woman is already sucked in.
I agree, Heather. And this is often, this is actually a really important point because this can actually, if women understand this concept, it can actually stop them getting into abusive relationships right at the start. Mm. They're 100% correct. There is a very strong grooming aspect to domestic violence where the perpetrator, when they first come into that relationship, do everything right. And they actually are very clever at reading what the victim wants and the dreams or wishes of the victim, and they will actually go about fulfilling them in the best way that they can, or at least promising the fulfillment of them. Mm. The other thing that's really important here too, Heather, is that relationships usually have take time. There's usually a general course where we meet and then we're acquaintances and then we start to trust and share debt more deeply. And then over time, as the trust builds, we might then get into a relationship with this person. Mm. But these people actually come straight into our inner sanctum very, very quickly. Like you said, there's that sense where they kind of know what we want and what we need, and they're all things to us. They're the one. We finally sweep us off our feet. We can't believe it. And then we trust them very quickly without even thinking this relationship is happening way too fast. It's way too intense. And we're jumping so many stages. Now, looking back, that is a really big red flag.
Yeah.
Because often what women don't realize is they're being groomed and their rights are actually being violated because that person's getting through their boundaries very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks so lovely that it feels it feels exciting even.
Yeah, yeah. And then we come to the sexual aspects. I wonder if you'd like to talk a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. So sexual abuse is very underreported in domestic violence. It can be take many forms. It can be you know, shaming the other person for what they're wearing, or your top's too low, or you look like a whore, or, you know, name calling, sexual name calling. It can also be accusations that the other person's always having an affair, that they've looked at someone when they haven't, that, you know, we went out to the pub tonight, I saw that man looking at you, therefore you are a slut, you shouldn't have worn what you wore. I've worked with many, many women where their partners have picked out their clothing, told them what they can and can't wear, accused them constantly of having affairs. If they're going out to the shop to get the groceries, all of a sudden they're accused of meeting up with someone. So that constant badgering and undermining of, you know, your sexuality and your right to choose what you wear and where you go. There's also the more dangerous aspects of it, which can include, you know, forced sex, rape, unwanted acts, you know, where the woman kind of goes outside what's comfortable with her because she's fearful. It might, and you know, most extremely it can include rape, but it can also include so many other things in between, where the woman feels sexually degraded, sexually compromised, sexually unsafe, and doesn't actually have the right to say no.
And there's some of those sort of subtly abusive games where the abusive partner can ask for much more than the woman would be prepared to give, way more, and then say, well, at least you could do this. At least you could do that. That's the minimum. Yep. And even that is beyond what's acceptable to her.
Absolutely. And absolutely. And then that conversation can take the form of, well, if you won't do that, I'll go and sleep with so-and-so and they'll do that for me. And often you find perpetrators actually do have affairs, and that can be part of the sexual abuse as well. You have no freedom, and I have freedom that's beyond the bounds of this relationship. Once again, you know, dominance and control, and then total freedom, and, you know, I can do what I like. Different rules.
Absolutely. Now, how many more of these have we got to discuss, because I'm feeling the intensity of this, and I think we've probably got four or five more of your 11 still to go. Would you like to move on into some of those?
I can move on. Huge. Yeah, absolutely. And these are, some of these are more newer ones that have come out lately, but and some aren't. There is stalking. Stalking is a very extreme form of abuse, but it can also, once again, be very subtle. It can take the form of just texting, you know, calling, how are you, being intrusive into your workplace. Oh, I'm calling to see how you're going. Well, I'm busy. Oh, don't you love me? Can't you take my call? I know I've worked with many women who've received, you know, 20, 30, 40 texts a day from their partner, or don't receive texts from their partner until they're with someone else, out shopping with a friend, out for a girl's night out, and then they receive all the texts. It can also, you know, it can also include physical stalking. It can also include getting someone else to stalk you, turning up unexpectedly. All of those things instill fear in the other person, in the victim, and establish control. Not only stalking is one of those ones that starts to establish control over the person's environment. Another one is digital abuse, which can also look like digital stalking. So, but that can also be the threats to put photos up publicly, or put things about you up on Facebook or Instagram, or threats of doing that. Where you actually lose control of your image, and that's threatened, and that can be extremely abusive, and threats of, I'll put that up and you'll lose your job, or your family won't speak to you. So once again, with the purpose of intimidation and fear.
All again, control.
Other types of abuse, Heather, you know, reproductive abuse. So this can take many forms, not letting a woman have contraception, keeping a woman pregnant all the time, you know, forcing her in a way to have many children, or not have an abortion, or have an abortion, force a woman to have an abortion. So all of those things, once again, cutting up her contraception, hiding it, replacing it. So tricks and all these kind of manipulations, so that the woman is no longer in control of her choice around whether to have a child or not.
Very powerful.
Very powerful. The last two post-separation abuse is now being singled out as a separate form of abuse. A lot of women that I've worked with say, oh, as soon as I leave him, it'll be great because the abuse will stop. Now, sadly, it doesn't, because the pattern of that, the way that that person relates to you is domineering and controlling, and that does not stop after you separate. They often escalate in the way that they become controlling and they change their tactics. And just a reminder too that women are at most danger when they're pregnant and when they're leaving.
Right. Yes, that makes sense.
So, yeah, and post-separation abuse can actually also involve threatening a woman, you can't leave. If you leave, I'll hurt you, or I'll hurt the children, or I'll hurt the dog, or I'll do this, or I'll tell your boss that. So post-separation abuse can actually almost be preventing separation in a way. And then the last form of abuse, which I consider to be the most prevalent in a way, is emotional abuse. We've already talked a little bit about brainwashing and that, but every form of abuse, stalking, verbal abuse, spiritual abuse, every form of abuse I've mentioned has an emotional abusive content. As soon as you're being physically abused, that's emotion. There's an emotional aspect of that. So it's probably important to realise that underneath all the forms of abuse is an emotional component, and emotional abuse is one of the most damaging, manipulative, mind-fogging forms of abuse that happens for women. I've worked with many women that have said, I wish he would just hit me because then I could see it.
Yeah.
But I know, I know this, yeah.
The other stuff is so much more subtle. Mm.
It's so much more subtle, and women find it hard to describe, and they find it hard to put their finger on. And they're told, as we've already talked about, that it's either not happening or not, or it's their fault, and therefore there's so much shame and confusion. Mm. So therefore it's very hard to come out that this is happening.
And it fits for me with our traditional roles as women, which are still there, even though we live very differently. We want to care for people. We want to please. We want to make things right. We want to make things better. And I think all of those things can really be exploited and abused.
I agree, Heather. Some of the most beautiful women I've ever worked with are women who have been victims of domestic violence. The depth of their caring, the way they can love, the sincerity of their intention to have a beautiful home and look after their children. Mm. Yeah, I totally agree with you. That can be severely exploited.
Right. So could you reiterate once more, just, if somebody does find themselves in one of these relationships, what could they do?
Sure. The most important thing, I think, there's a couple of important things. One important thing is to educate yourself on what's happening. So if after today you think this might be my relationship, get online. There are so many online resources, and have a look at the different types of abuse. And if you find yourself making excuses for the perpetrator, like, oh, well, it's not really that bad, or, but he had a, oh, he only does that every now and again, that's probably a bit of a sign as well that you're starting to make excuses and kind of minimise what's happening. But get online, educate yourself. I also, breaking the silence increases safety, but it's really important to choose who you tell. So my encouragement is always to go to a domestic violence specialist service, because they actually operate in frameworks where they keep you safe, while you actually learn more about it and decide what you can do. Once again, you can Google local resources in your area. There are also support services out there for men who find themselves in domestic violence relationships. While there's not a lot of services, there are now on the radar, at least in Australia, that are being funded much more specialised services that are actually understand the dynamics of what men go through. So that would be my important thing. Don't stand up to the abusive person. It's not safe to do that. You need to stage this approach. You need to learn about it, get linked in with the service, get a safety and protection plan, and then make decisions after you've got that framework around you.
And presumably keep that private from the person who's abusing you.
It's really important, Heather. Keep it private. Don't talk to them about, guess what, I went on a podcast today and I learned all about this. this is something you need to keep to yourself. If you're starting to go to services and you've got resources around, you need to keep them in a safe place, or let someone else look after them for you, or keep them at work. It is not the type of thing that you start to talk to the abuser about, because what it does is invites the abuser to become more abusive. And they might be thinking, oh, you're onto me, so you're starting to call me on this. And often what happens is the abuse escalates.
Mm. Yep, it ups the ante. So the domination ups has got to increase. Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's really important to realise that if you're in a relationship where there's power and control and you start to stand up for yourself, the abuser uses more power and more control and more tactics to gain the power over you, because they will always make sure they do that.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
The other thing I'd probably just add in there, if you're listening to this and there are very different levels of violence, and if you've got a partner that's, you know, does things like strangle you when you're having fights and things like that, there are signs that the relationship is incredibly dangerous. So if you're sitting there and you're thinking, wow, my partner could kill me, then you really actually need to take action quite quickly by contacting a domestic violence service and getting them to help you be safe.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Helen. And I think there are lots of resources out there. I'm thinking particularly of Melanie Tonia Evans on YouTube. She's got lots of resources. And I'm thinking of any sort of coaching programs or whatever that create empowerment for women, help us rediscover ourselves when we're lost, help us really discover what we want out of our lives and have the support to really think about that and create the possibilities for ourselves. Now, you and I both do our conscious uncoupling coaching. I know you're not taking clients at the moment, we both are, and there's your colleague in Australia, Angela Barrett, who loves that work too. And also there's a register for that with Catherine Woodward Thomas. So there are people doing this work all over the world that can help you make the best of your relationship parting, so that you don't go on to do this again with somebody else, and you get the best sort of relationship you can manage in separating from somebody who's been abusive.
I agree with you totally, Heather. And maybe one more thing to throw out there is that if you're sitting there and you realise these tactics are happening in your relationship, a lot of people might go into couples counselling and think that, you know, oh, we can do this together. Probably just really important to remember that the perpetrator is responsible solely for their behaviour, that they are responsible for stopping the violence, and that the victims, evidence has shown, have absolutely no impact on whether the perpetrator stops their violence. So for those of you that are sitting there going, I can help my partner through this, oh, if only I did this differently, he would stop doing that, that's actually not the case. Being violent towards another person is a choice. And it's a crime. And in even the subtle forms, none of it is okay, and it is not your fault. So for those of you that might be listening thinking I'm a victim in here, it's really important to know that it's your responsibility to be safe and find a way to not be in these types of relationships, but it is always the perpetrator's responsibility to stop the violence.
That's a beautiful note to complete on. Thank you so much, Helen. This is Helen Eisenhower from Sydney, Australia. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Heather, for your interest in doing this most important podcast. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I'll hope you'll join us for the next ones. We're going to do a series of four. And maybe, Helen, you might like to just outline what the next ones will be.
Absolutely, Heather. The next one will be on the myths. There is a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions in the community about what actually domestic violence or intimate partner violence is. So we're going to do a bit of a myth busters in our next one and actually explode some of those myths that a lot of us carry around without even challenging them. Then the third one will look at the the cycle of domestic abuse or intimate partner violence, that it often happens in a pattern that's quite predictable. So we'll talk about the cycle of violence and also how the victims feel during that and what they can do. And then the last one we'll be talking about is, what do I do now? If I realise this is me, what are some more detailed steps on what I can do to keep myself safe and either leave this relationship or make sure that I don't get into one in the future?
Yes, beautiful. And how to safeguard the children too. I think you mentioned Absolutely. That we would cover that. That's brilliant.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Helen. That's really
Thank
wonderful.
Thank you, Heather.
I shall look forward to talking again.
Yeah, look forward to next time. Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Revolutionize Your Love Life. I'd like to know what has been your biggest takeaway from this conversation. Do take a minute and share this with us and visit us on our Facebook page. You can connect with me personally on my email at heather@heathergarbutt.com. If you can think of someone who will benefit from listening to this podcast, please do share it with them. If you have any feedback on how I can improve it, please do reach out to me, as I'm always keen to learn more. Thank you so much again for listening, and we'll meet again on the next episode of Revolutionize Your Love Life.